Welcome to Trent Voices, the Trent University Alumni Affairs Show on Trent Radio. I'm your host, Donald Fraser of Alumni Affairs. It is Friday, July the 15th, and this is episode 41. Our interview today is taking place via Skype, as a lot of this summer season will. Our guest, 28-year-old alumnus and teacher Mark Quattrocci. And Mark is on the line from Rideau Ferry near Ottawa, where he recently returned from an incredible 2-year journey that saw him crossing 40 countries and an astonishing 35,000 kilometers in an effort that raised over $48,000 for Free the Children, an international charity and youth empowerment movement that was co-founded by honorary Trent alumnus Craig Kielberger. It was an amazing journey by an amazing individual, which makes me very proud to welcome the dedicated Mark Quattrocci to Trent Voices. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you, Donald.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned that this is our kind of our Skype season. It's summer, so we're not in the studios of Trent Radio. We're in Alumni House, and it's great to have you here. Before we get to your journey and your charitable work, I gotta ask, how are the legs?
The legs are a little less sore than usual. I'm taking some time right now. I still ride my bike once in a while, but not as much as I used to, that's for sure.
Was there a recoup period where you had to where you had to kind of get your land legs back?
Not so much. I mean, getting around from A to B on my bicycle now just isn't the same as what I used to kind of put in on a daily basis, kind of 130 type kilometer days. So the little commutes I do here aren't so stressful anymore.
Well, you blow me away. As a cyclist, I take a look at what you do, and I'm utterly blown away. It was a huge ride. It raised an incredible amount of money. What got it started? What inspired you? What got you thinking of riding really pretty much around the world for charity?
Right, so the idea actually kind of came to me back when I was actually in Trent University some 7 years ago. I was, I think, in my third year, and I was reading this book by a man named Alistair Humphreys. He's a adventurer, this cyclist that had actually rode his own bicycle around the world on this journey. As I read this book, I was blown away that something like that is even possible. So kind of that night, I wrote down, I'm going to ride my bicycle around the world, and even as I wrote it down, I didn't really think it would happen. I didn't have a bicycle. I didn't have any extra money, and I was still going to school. But it was always this dream that I kind of had from that moment on. Eventually, I got a job teaching in South Korea, teaching English for a year. I found I really liked education, and I went back to Trent University and got my bachelor's of education. After that, I got a job teaching at a Canadian school in China. It was an excellent job. I had a wonderful life there, but it was at that moment I knew that was the starting location. I knew I would have a bit of extra money. It was far enough from home that it would be where I wanted to begin, and it was just the right time. So there was this journey that was always in the back of my mind, this dream, but I didn't know how to start it. And if I didn't begin at that point, I thought I would never do it.
Well, and you bring up money, and you bring up the fact that you were able to do this at this point. But the fact of the matter is you were doing it for money, just not money for you. It was for Free the Children. So tell me a bit about Free the Children and why they are so important to you.
Right. So as I started this journey, I knew I didn't want to do more than just, you know, ride circles around the world. I wanted to kind of give back. And as a teacher, education was something that was really important to me. So I started searching around, and Free the Children kept coming up every time. And after a couple of phone calls and emails back and forth, I knew that they were the best match for me. They work in all areas of a sustainable development, which I'm really passionate about. But I chose to partner with education as a teacher because I know how important it is to the lives of kids around the world. And it's something that we really do take for granted here in Canada. So I started my goals off kind of what I thought was not low, but it was a goal that I hoped I would achieve, but had no idea if I could. Basically $10,000, which is the cost of a schoolhouse. Okay. I I set my original goal at that $10,000, but very quickly people all over the world rose to the occasion and started donating from all over, and I reached the $10,000 in the first 3 months of my journey. So after that, I decided that I would partner with five of the schools in five different locations around the world, and now I'm less than $2,000 from the final goal of $50,000.
And that is astounding. I mean, it's well, first of all, that's a huge amount of money, and
absolutely.
And we're going to get back to that. But it was also a huge ride, and so I want to get into this. 35,000 kilometers is a tough distance for people to wrap their heads around. Take us a little bit through your route.
Right. So I never knew exactly how long it was going to be, but I knew it was going to be quite the ride. Beginning in China, I was living on the island of Hainan, kind of China's secret. And it's kind of where people go in the winter, like China's Florida or something like that, to get away from the cold. So I biked across the island. I was unbelievably out of shape at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't overweight or anything like that. I was just, you know, I wasn't used to biking these long days. So I biked across the island eventually, and then took a quick boat to the mainland of China, where I then rode across the entire continent of, not the continent, the country of China, to a little country called Kyrgyzstan. China itself took me over 3 months to ride, and it was almost 6,000 kilometers just in China.
Wow.
It was an amazing ride up huge mountains and across massive deserts and expanses and through cultures I never even knew existed. Into Kyrgyzstan, this is kind of the old Silk Road route, you know, Marco Polo, all these adventures you kind of read about, on down into Uzbekistan and eventually Afghanistan. I went to Afghanistan for a number of different reasons. Namely, first, I was not granted an Iran visa.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up thinking, okay, what can I do now? And I did some research and I found that going to Afghanistan was actually a great possibility, and it would be an eye-opening experience. So I took a bit of a risk and went down into Afghanistan, and it was what I would think, looking back on my ride, one of the most memorable places I ever went on my entire journey, just because of the things I learned there and saw the way the people live and how kind they were to me as an outsider. From there, I made my way over to India. I did a huge loop of India and back, because that's what any smart person would do, taking almost 3 months down to the tip in India and back to New Delhi. At this time, I realized my ride around the world couldn't be this beautiful straight line with certain countries blocking the route. I originally had planned to go to Syria, and that completely changed over the years as the conflict rose there. So I flew to Istanbul and made my way across Europe through the Balkans and down through Italy, eventually over to, I took a boat to Malta, this tiny little island, and from there I was again stuck. I knew I wanted to get to Africa, but crossing through Libya wasn't the best choice at the time. So I eventually took another quick airplane to Cairo in Egypt and made my way all the way down Eastern Africa, taking about 6 months to get to Cape Town. At the end of Africa, I was a little bit worn out. I'd already been on the road for quite a while, but I had to finish what I started. I had friends and family back home all encouraging me on, so I got on an airplane, made my way to Buenos Aires, and started cycling my way up all through South America, all the way up to Peru, where I actually took a series of boats all the way up the Amazon to Ecuador. That was a nice break from the bicycle, but also a wonderful experience I'll never forget. Eventually, I made my way to Ecuador, as I said, and up through Colombia, where, again, there was this huge roadblock called the Darien Gap.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't quite ride my bike through there. I ended up taking four boats across the Pacific side over to Panama, all the way up through Central America, Mexico, across the United States and back home to Canada.
It's first of all, wow. I mean,
that's, when I say it like that, yeah.
Well, I think people that do need to get the scope of what this is. But then I want to go back to what you said, where you're in Africa and you're thinking, okay, well, I'm feeling kind of tired. But yeah, I'm just gonna, you know, finish off this little trip, which is, you know, essentially going north-south through the entire Americas. Were there any points where you said, you know what, I can't do this? Screw it, I'm just gonna chuck it in, I'm done.
There were a number of times where I felt like, this is it. But I kind of made a pact with myself that those moments where I usually wanted to quit had to do with bad weather, mm-hmm. or me being sick, or, you know, just kind of missing home type moments. But if I was ever out on my actual bike on a clear, nice day, and I truly still wanted to quit, then I told myself, then you can go home.
Yeah.
If it's a beautiful day and you still want to throw in the towel, you can go home. But there was never a moment like that.
Did you have to psych yourself up? Was there, you know, it had to have been both psychologically and physically demanding. What did you do to keep yourself pumped up and going?
Right. So there were many low moments throughout my journey. But to get myself pumped up, it was really one of the things that kept me going was the charity, actually.
Cool.
I'd be feeling low or something like that, and I would get another donation from someone I hadn't heard of in for a while, or someone I didn't even know, and then I would connect with them. And that was always a huge pump me up. As well as I have my fiance, who was always behind me 110% and keeping me going. You know, when she heard all the stories, more than anyone ever heard of, you know, my low moments and my, you know, complaining about the day-to-day things. But I think in the end, it was just my personal goal and dream, this end goal that I had always kind of thought of I would achieve and for my, not for anyone else, but myself. And I knew if I didn't finish this thing, then I would always have that I didn't do it, I didn't complete my dream kind of thing in the back of my head. So I pushed forward through some tough days, and I made it to the end eventually, but I can't thank the people around the world that and the contributors to the charity that really did help keep me going.
You bring up the day-to-day, and I think that's one of the things that people probably can't wrap their heads around is what your day-to-day life looked like. I mean, 135, it was 135 clicks per day on average, you said?
Depending on the country. If it was flat, you know, not so hilly kind of ground, then like in the United States and places like that, I could easily do 130.
Mm-hmm.
But if I was in somewhere like Bolivia, where the roads are not so nice and the climbs are massive, then my days are a bit shorter for sure, around 70 kilometers.
So what was an average day like? Was most of it on the bike?
Most of it was spent on the bike, especially as I got more fit. In the beginning, I had more days off, as mm-hmm. my body wasn't used to riding 7 days a week, 100 and some kilometers a day. But by the end, I was on the bike about 7 days, off one kind of thing. And I wake up, I usually try to camp, because mm-hmm. Especially near the end, money ran a little bit tight. But my greatest memories are from camping and the adventures that came with that. Wake up, pack up my tent, maybe cook a little breakfast if I needed to, or stop at a local place for something to eat, and then head out for the day, ride, eat, repeat kind of thing. And it did, in some days, it really was sort of a routine. This routine of, I knew I had to get a place to sleep, I knew I had to eat this much amount of food kind of thing, but what it was in between was all this beautiful scenery and the people I was able to meet.
I was going to say, a heck of a routine that you've got, though.
Yeah. A really wild routine, yeah. And so, especially riding, I never had to ride the same road twice.
Mm-hmm.
So that something is always new and something is always definitely interesting to see.
There's a couple different directions I want to go, but you bring up food, and that's an area that I'm going to. You got to feed yourself, and when you're on a bike and you can carry very little, you're eating wherever you are. What was that experience like on the cuisine front when you're hopscotching through basically every culture on the planet? How did feeding yourself work?
Well, I always kind of made a point of eating what the locals eat. because I know that that really is the key to many, many cultures, is food. So I'd always try to find out what are the locals eating. I go to the local markets. That's kind of where I do my shopping. At night, a lot of the times, out on the road, for sure, I always cook my regular old pasta. Mm-hmm. I ate the same pasta for almost 2 years, but it was just what I needed to eat at the end of the day if I didn't have a restaurant to go to or some local little stand to get some food from. But throughout the world, I got to experience some of the most amazing food that this world has to offer, and everyone has their own take, and they're really proud of their food. And just telling someone at a local restaurant, like, well, this is delicious kind of thing, you see their face brighten up, and they want to share their culinary treats with the world. And if you are from a different country, maybe they're a little bit worried if you're going to like it. And I never really did eat too many things I didn't enjoy. I was always really hungry, so it didn't really matter.
Yeah, I mean, hunger is the best spice. Was there anything that you came across on a culinary front where you were like, I don't know that I can do it? What was the strangest thing that was put on your plate?
I'm not sure. I mean, living in Asia I've lived there for 3 years.
Yeah.
I ate a lot of different things, live squid and things like dog and different types of animals we normally don't eat over here. But on the bicycle ride, there weren't too many things that I was offered that kind of made me squeamish. In Central Asia, they're not quite known for their food.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a lot of really unappetizing meats. Kind of the parts that we normally don't eat in Canada, the parts that get thrown away.
Yeah.
And so that wasn't my favorite. But throughout the rest of the journey, there was not much I kind of shied away from.
You bring up the fact that food really brings people together. And you must have met thousands of people from a huge, huge array of cultures. What did meeting so many people of so many very, very different historical, ethnic backgrounds tell you about our species as a whole, about our global community? You're getting a snapshot of all these cultures. What happens when you view them as a whole?
Right, so that's a very good question, actually. I mean, stepping back from after the whole thing was done, it's really easy to say a couple of things about the way we are as a species, as you say. I found that we really are all not that different, that we all kind of want the same things in life, the few things that make us, I think, human. Family, close by, friends, as well as food on the table, roof over our head, and a place to sleep. I think all of the basic necessities really are what we want as humans and makes us humans. We all just want to really be happy, and I think in certain cultures, I definitely saw people that were as happy as I've ever seen with less than we definitely have here in Canada, far less than we definitely have here in Canada. And I think that we get lost sometimes by all the things that we think we're supposed to have. And in the end, in those dying days, maybe you're in the hospital room or something like that, and you're not going to remember all those gadgets you had throughout life, the new iPhone and those types of things. Those are off the table. What you're going to remember and want others to remember about you, and I think this goes throughout humanity, is the life that you lived and those that follow around you.
When you were on the road, first of all, you were living a life that very few people got to, and you got to see things that very few people will get to see, at least in such a concentrated period. You were going through many, many marvels of the world, landscapes that people can only read about in books or online. What were some of the highlights of the landscape or the architect, the surroundings that you biked through?
It's a definitely a difficult question, but I did get to experience all these wonderful landscapes. China in my opinion, is just jam-packed full of these types of wonders. You know, you always hear about the Great Wall, but you don't hear about the other things, like what I experienced in the Tibetan Plateau, as well as the landforms that are really hard to access, like in Gansu and Xinjiang province, that are really off any sort of beaten track. I will always remember going through Afghanistan to the Blue Mosque. It's a kind of a site of pilgrimage for many people throughout the Muslim world. So experiencing that as definitely as an outsider was something I'll never forget. As well, I saw the Taj Mahal, the pyramids, as well as Machu Picchu, the Amazon rainforest, the Panama Canal, to name a few of the different places I got to see throughout the world. But all those landscapes and views don't compare to just what was really in between. All the people I got to meet, as well as the different cultures I got to experience along the way. The bicycle ride wasn't about all these big sights. Those were amazing things to see and kind of kept me focused along the way. But what was important was the experiences I had on the day-to-day basis.
And again, we're back to the day-to-day. I'm a cyclist. I ride to Trent most days. I'm happy on my bike. I've done some touring, and I know what it's like to pack up gear. I took a look at your rig, and I think to myself, how do you pack? what were you carrying, and how was it to go so long with just your bare essentials? Take us through what you were carrying with you.
Right, so it was kind of, as you say, what would you pack kind of thing for a two-year trip, and it was quite hard in the beginning, but after I got the hang of it, I realized what I don't need, and kind of gave away a lot of things that are kind of extra. But basically, I was carrying one of my front bags was completely full of clothes, and I had an iPad in there. That was it. All my clothes were stuffed into one bag, and I would just kind of rotate what I needed, and I didn't have a lot of change of clothes. So I was kind of washing things as I went at night if I had the opportunity. If not, I tried to find a place to wash as soon as possible, just so you don't get rashes and things like that in the sun. My other bag was a front bag. Was full of kind of odds and ends. I eventually had a hammock in there for sleeping in hot weather, as well as some books and kind of cords and things like that for all the electronics I needed to stay connected with home. Really, in the back, it was quite simple too. These are the two bigger bags in the back. I had my sleeping gear, like sleeping bags, and different things for cooking and camping, kind of all self-sustaining type items. I had a camera, a DSLR camera, because I like taking photos, and a GoPro. In the other back bag, I had like all of my bicycle repair stuff, extra medicine, extra bike parts, and my sleeping mat. I would usually carry extra food and water in that bag as well. And then I have my tent and a camelback for carrying even more water in kind of desert locations. So when I really look back on all these things that I carried around the world, there's not much kind of that is extra. I remember I had a deck of cards and like a harmonica, which I never played. Yeah. But these types of things were like luxuries. And I always kind of wanted to get rid of them because I was like, as you're climbing up a massive hill that takes all day in Peru, like a 75-kilometer hill, then you really question what you're carrying.
I want to know about the contents of the one bag. You bring up the stuff that's needed to fix your bike, so your toolkit and your first aid kit are both in that bag. How often did you have to go to that bag?
Well, the repair kit almost in some places almost daily.
Yeah.
If my tires were running low, or my spokes were breaking often, then I was fixing things a couple of times a day sometimes. My record for flat tires was 6 in 1 day in India.
Ouch!
And that really wears on you.
Where were we getting tubes from?
Those were fairly cheap tubes, and my tires were worn out.
Yeah.
So that was just one of those things you had to deal with. But yeah, in other countries, when the riding was a little bit smoother and I wasn't traveling over whole horrible things on the road, then I could use my repair kit less, and that was nice. When I was like, oh, I haven't had a patch of tire in a few days, I was really happy about that. The medicine kit was rarely ever used, though. I remember being sick twice. That kind of kept me off the road,
yeah.
Other than kind of knee problems once in a while.
So, again, you made your way across a huge distance. You were doing a whole bunch of fundraising for Free the Children. Where do you see that money going in the future?
Right. So, as I made my way around the world, I decided that I wanted to partner with specific communities in order to build schoolhouses there, kind of places I was visiting along the way. So as I made my way around the world, I was able to visit 4 of the 5 communities where there are now schools that my contributors have helped make, basically. So the first one was in China, in Sichuan province. I was unable to visit that school because of a flood. Which was unfortunate. I do hope to go back one day and visit that community, but we'll see what happens with that in the next little while. The second school was in India, in Rajasthan province, and I was actually able to visit the community and meet the people and hear their stories. And it really, I think at that point, as I was sending photos home to family and friends and putting them online on my website, people could see the impact of their donations and what the difference really was in the lives of these people. Simply seeing a smile from someone across the world because you're making their lives better and giving them hope is such a powerful thing. And then the third school, which I partnered with in Kenya, is now constructed, as well as the school in China and India. Was also another unforgettable time, getting to see the people there and hearing, actually, I'll never forget hearing the story of the girls' school in Kisaruni. Some of the most passionate young women I've ever met in my life about being able to go to school, because in most of the world, public education is not free. It is free up to only about grade 6, and so all these girls know that they would not be going to school without the help of different people around the world, and they're so grateful for what they're able to achieve and how they're able to live their lives and the hope they're able to give to their families. The fourth school was in Ecuador, and I traveled up to the Andes region, in that case, up on the side of a mountain, a beautiful landscape, and another welcoming, wonderful community, and I was actually able to help dig the foundation of that school.
Oh, cool.
Another thing I'll never forget, for sure. I was a bit ahead of schedule with my fundraising at that point, so they had already begun the construction, kind of broke ground, so to speak. And now that we've decided on the fifth school, which I'm just $2,000 shy of, in Nicaragua, in the community of El Chapichi, and it won't be long now before the construction begins there. And I can't believe that I'm saying that kind of thing, that we're so close to the fifth goal of $50,000.
You're talking about the schools that you're building. For a second,
yes.
I want to talk about the school that you came from. I'm talking to you from Alumni House at Trent University, and I talk to alumni all the time about the impact that Trent had on their lives. I mean, and they're not, usually it's applied to a career thing, a job, a project they're working on, as compared to a journey across the planet. How did Trent prepare you for this really, really unique experience?
Well, I think Trent taught me a lot, not only through the books and the teachers I got to experience, but as it taught me about how to be a human. The setting of Trent University itself is a beautiful campus right within nature, and that was the kind of place I really connected with. The first time I went to the school, I thought immediately, yep, that's where I'm going. And, you know, as a kid in grade 12, you do all the tours at different campuses. And as soon as I saw Trent, I thought, that's for me. And it really taught me a lot throughout the years as I grew in my classes. And as we go to Trent, we realize how lucky we are to be in such a small class size and in those types of situations. I'll never forget the friends I went to school with at Trent, and I stay in contact with a lot of them still. Even on my ride home, I was meeting some of my friends along the way that I went to Trent with. And I'll always look back on those moments as something that was really powerful, because of the connection that Trent really creates among friends and the community at large. It's a really passionate school, and I think that it really teaches you a lot about how we are all connected, and it's kind of the message Trent is trying to promote is that we are, I think, all human kind of thing, and we all do have a voice. And when I had to make my decision of when I was coming back to go do my teacher's education, there was no doubt in my mind where I was going. I was praying that I'd get accepted, and once I did, I was so thankful that I could go back to Trent and get one more year out of the beautiful city of Peterborough and the wonderful people at Trent University.
The word connections came up a bunch of times, and I want to make sure that some of these connections are going to continue to happen. And in fact, foster new ones. I'm sure there are plenty of people in the Trent community that you know that want to reach out and find you just on a social level, and yet more who might want to reach out and help donate to your cause. What's the best way to find out about your journey, the charity, and how they can get involved?
Right. Thank you. I would like, if anyone would like to donate, they can always go on to my website. At oneadventureplease.com, and on the left hand side you'll see a little icon that says Free the Children, and that takes you directly to the donation page for the fifth and final school in Nicaragua. Throughout my website you can see all of my blog posts throughout the world. If you're interested in Sudan, you can click Sudan and it will take you right there. If you're interested in Malawi, Kyrgyzstan, anywhere in the world, you can just read about it with a couple clicks, as well as you can follow my Facebook page, or I have my Instagram on there as well, and anyone can send me an email anytime if they're looking to connect, maybe they would like me to speak in their area or something like that. At the moment, I'm giving talks on my ride. I call it kind of finding your bicycle ride, and what that basically entails is I use my bicycle ride as a jumping off point to encourage other people to go out and find what their dream is in life. And I believe that we all have this dream somewhere inside of us. I realize that not every person wants to ride their bicycle around the world. Maybe many people are already living their bicycle ride, but I think that inside of us all is something great. And now that I'm finished, kind of I'm getting the questions, you know, what's next? And I think that I had to find my new adventure, because it doesn't stop there. My life isn't over now that I've finished my my ultimate dream. I'm currently working on a book about the journey around the world and continuing, as I said, to speak about finding your bicycle ride.
Mark, the fact that your dream wasn't just about yourself, but was about helping and empowering other people, is astounding, and you should be extremely proud of what you've accomplished. It's something that most of the planet couldn't dream themselves of doing, and as a result, it's really been an honor talking to you today. We are out of time, but I do want to thank you for taking part, and I want to thank you for the work that you've done.
Thank you so much for having me, and I can't tell you how much it means to be a part of the Trent alumni community, and just to be on here today with you. Thank you, Donald.
Cheers. And we are going to have the contact information and the website for Mark on our website at trentu.ca/alumni. So be sure to check that out and be sure to check us out again. Once again, I'm Donald Fraser of Alumni Affairs. This has been Trent Voices. Be sure to follow us on all of the social medias, every single one of them. On Facebook at Trent University Alumni Association, and we have our lovely page there. On Twitter at Trent Alumni. On Instagram at Trent_alumni. On LinkedIn at the official Trent University Alumni Association page. And even, I'm not making this up, you can find us on Pokemon Go, where apparently there's an angry Weedle in our garden. I don't even know what that means. So there you go. But be sure to stay tuned. We have an incredible summer season coming up. And we're only getting started. You will definitely hear from us soon. Thanks, and have a great day.